died, Father, is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. If God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
And before now, history. To the unknown future. This is Red Ice Radio. For the Seeker.
I must strive to know.
Hello, listeners and friends. Welcome to another Red Ice Radio program. I'm Henrik, and we say thank you to everyone tuning in today, who probably just as me at some point has wondered, is there nothing more? The mundane bullshit of the world, is that it? Well, no, the good news is that there is more. There's actually tons of exciting and surprising things to discover, to learn about, and also to do. Some of it might not be so comfortable, but nonetheless, we try our best to cover much of this news and many of these insights, and hopefully help to get you inspired to look at things a little bit differently. Take a look at our website, redicecreations.com, where you can subscribe to our RSS feeds to get the program right into iTunes or other podcast software. We have a newsletter, we have apps, a mobile website. You can download all our available programs if you so please. We have over a year of archive shows available for free, no commercial interruptions, no blinking banners. Check it out. Today we're talking with Maria Wheatley, a writer, dowser, and researcher of Earth mysteries, specializing in the geodetic system of Earth energies and ley lines. She organizes regular tours of sacred sites and medieval churches and cathedrals in the southwest of England to locate and interact with the monument's hidden energies. Her late father, Dennis Wheatley, was considered a master dowser who discovered the hidden chakra system within Glastonbury Abbey and how it was ritualistically used by the royal bloodline. For the past 10 years, Maria has continued researching the many ways in which our prehistoric ancestor harnessed and utilized the Earth force. Wheatley has studied landscape archaeology with the University of Bath in Swindon. She is the co-author of Avebury, Sun, Moon, and Earth, and she recently founded the Avebury School of Esoteric Studies. Today, we're going to explore some ancient concepts and new findings related to the geodetic system of Earth energies and ley lines. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Maria. Good to have you on the program. First of all, thanks for taking the time talking with us. We appreciate it. Hope you're having a good day over in the UK.
Thanks for inviting me.
Why don't we introduce you a little bit to our audience? You can choose where to begin. Where would be a good place? I mean, we can talk a little bit about your father, Dennis, of course, or if we want to go straight into the dowsing of this. Maybe you can tell us how you got involved. I guess it must have everything to do with your father, correct?
Well, that's right. I'm a second generation dowser, and I learned about sort of earth energies and sacred sites in the UK and in France through my late father's research. Because what he did, he looked at all the different types of earth energies that were integrated into the megalithic architecture of iconic stone structures in the UK, like Stonehenge, like Avebury, and earthen mounds such as Silbury. And what I've done with that is I don't just douse. I suppose I want more than anecdotal evidence. I want more than what my father suggested. So I also work closely with the team, and we look for ionization over earth energy pulse points, for example. And we also take radiation tests using Geiger counters and test for electromagnetic energy associated with the earth energies.
And your father, Dennis, he was obviously considered like a master dowser, and he also discovered the hidden chakra system actually within Glastonbury Abbey. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, you see, churches which were laid out traditionally by Master Masons and the Knights Templar, for example, encoded special areas within the building. So if we imagine that, you know, like a large cathedral or a large church covers some distance, the axis line is normally east-west, facing the rising sun, for example. When you walk down that access line, you're actually integrating with certain earth energies and certain symbolism within the church. So, for example, where the choir sit and obviously sing, that represents the throat chakra. And so we look at a kind of layout of a church in relation to the chakra system. So as you're walking down the axis of the church, you're walking down through your own body, often perceived to be, you know, the body of the Christ as well, or in a church dedicated to Saint Mary or Saint Mary Magdalene, that would represent the feminine body within the church. And you'd interact with these certain points, because today in churches, the only chakra that is kind of opened, if you will, is the third eye chakra. When you're baptized, you often in the UK have a cross of water placed across the baby's third eye, and that opens the third eye chakra. But how the ancient bloodline used to use it, the royal European bloodline, is they used to walk down the chakra system, symbolically open up all their chakras to the higher forces above them.
How far back does this knowledge go, do you think? I've heard stories about Egypt and many of the temples there being in dedication, obviously, to the image of man and the various body parts, including the energy body of the human body as well. But how far back does it go, and how far back does it go in England specifically?
In England, it goes back a long, long way. It goes back to the ancient monuments of the Neolithic. That's around sort of 3,800 BC. In the layout of Longbarrow. There's not much difference in the spiritual design canon, for instance, between a Longbarrow, such as West Kennet Longbarrow or Wayland Smithy here in the UK, than to a cathedral. They're actually laid out quite identical. So obviously it was the earliest people here in the UK that practiced this, and that was handed down through the eras, right the way down to the Victorian mystery schools. It's always been handed down, normally to secret societies.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm wondering about the connection between Longbarrows and cathedrals, because I've heard, at least for years, Maria, about the connection between Christianity and various previous religions, be it that Druidism or something even more ancient in the UK. Do you think that there is have been a lending of knowledge back and forth between the various cultures, and hence we can see a mirroring going on between them, or has it been stolen? How would you define it?
I would define it as it has always been a one religion, a one knowledge-based center that has just been kind of put in a different guise with Christianity, because there is no real difference between the real concepts of Christianity to the ancient Druid practices, to the ancient Neolithic practices. They all have a very, very similar understanding. And that understanding comes with knowing about the energies within the earth and also the spiritual forces above them. And the kind of ancient sites were like gelling the two together.
Hmm. So would you say that this knowledge has been lost? Do we, I mean, what you're talking about today is not common knowledge. It's, in terms of the scientific and all that, right? This is like considered to be pseudoscience these days. Although if you go further back in history, it was like the common knowledge at the time. It seems like it's been pushed to the side. And if so, how and why did this happen, do you think?
I think at one time, like going back again to the prehistoric era of about 3000 BC, it was probably quite common knowledge. However, as time sort of pressed on to the Druid period and the Dark Ages, for example, here in the UK, it seems that certain people became the kind of custodians of that knowledge. And those custodians of that knowledge kept it very much to themselves. And that probably began with the Druids. And certainly by the time of the Templars. I mean, if you take any design of a Templar church here in England, for example, the iconic Temple Church in London, it's very round. It has a very round structure. And the types of energies that was incorporating were identical to that which is emitted within stone circles. So it's like it was just handed down and handed down. And make no mistake, that even royal European families to date, such as the Habsburgs of Europe, for example, they have always been associated with the Catholic Church, dating back to the 14th century.
Yeah.
They certainly integrate earth energies into their death rites and their catacombs in Vienna and various places. And even today, in the recent sad departure of Otto von Habsburg, for example, he was an unelected European Member of Parliament. And yet all of these people really know about how to activate the earth force for them, for themselves and for their family dynasties. So it isn't really just a kind of few people that know about it. It's actually quite wider. It's just not really spoken about. And ancient Chinese geomants and feng shui masters, they practice a very similar science to the Europeans, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I haven't thought about it that way, but my perception was that for a while it has to go. It had to go underground. It seems like it was when the Catholic Church got a grip on most of the European continent. It was a lot of this knowledge seems to have been pushed out. Is that a correct perception? Do you think? I mean, we have the story of the Templars kind of being persecuted, going underground, pretty much, and trying to preserve it in some way or another. Do you think that's the right perception of the situation?
I think that's the right perception, undoubtedly. But also, as well, with the master masons that build a lot of our cathedrals and churches, for instance, were fully aware of how to activate the whole kind of energetic side of a church and a cathedral with the harmonics and with the earth energies. They used to walk around a church in a certain way, for example. And this is the hierarchy church. This is the bishops. For example, when a bishop enters a church in Europe or in England, he will walk around the church in a certain way and he'll stand in a certain position because he knows how to activate that energy system within that church.
Well, that's very interesting. So they know more than they're saying, because certainly on the official capacity, this is not spoken of very widely now, is it?
No, it isn't spoken about widely on an official level, but on an unofficial level, the high-ranking members of the Catholics and the presidents alike do know about this system.
How do you think they're using it? We've had other guests, Maria. And we're going to shift focus, obviously, to talk more about Stonehenge later. We have a lot of things to get to here, but I want to ask you a little bit more about this. Do you think that, how have they used this system throughout the European continent of these massive cathedrals in places of that seems to be node points on the Earth energy grid? Have they used this in regard to their... I don't know what the terminology should be here, but advantage, have they learned to... Because many of the churches that we know are built on more ancient sacred sites, and they placed the cathedrals, practically smack on top over the previous kind of religious sites, if you will. So they've tapped into the energy and somehow they've learned to maybe cap it, use it to their advantage. Would you agree with that, or how would you kind of word that, Maria?
I would definitely agree with that, because if we look at how a church is laid out, with some physical features now, when you walk into an average church in the UK, in Europe, for example, you come in through the south door. Yeah, you always approach the church through the south door. And then as you walk down the axis line I was talking about, which is normally east-west, averagely speaking, you always get the pulpit on the left-hand side of the church. All churches tend to be laid out like that. And the pulpit is where, the vicar or the priest would preach from. Yep. And that's where they would give their sermon from. This is all about the spoken word. Yeah. One ancient rite that the old Catholics and Protestants alike knew of was the so-called Word of God. And the so-called Word of God was where, on the pulpit, it's literally plugged into what's called the third global grid system. And the third global grid system is orientated a particular way all around the planet. And it's about 50 degrees to the east of north. Yeah? So you go into a church, the pulpit tends to be aligned on that global grid system, which, by the way, was discovered by a physicist and not by a New Ager or a Dowser.
Okay.
But what was found about people interacting with this type of energy line, grid system, is it enhances the way that you speak. It enhances your ability to communicate, for example. So that's why, for instance, the pulpits are on that particular grid system, because it's believed to enhance your power of communication to the congregation, but more importantly, your connection and your communication to spiritual forces above. So that was the third global grid system, and that was one esoteric design canon used in churches throughout Europe, that is.
So they're using the very system of energy that naturally exists in an environment like this. They enhance it with the structure of the building to be able to, again, use it in their favor. That's very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And great universities in this country also do that. Take Oxford University, St. Mary's. It's world famous, isn't it, Oxford University? Same as Cambridge. But in Oxford, traditional university, that was an ancient Druid college called a core, C-O-R. And again, all of the places where people would talk and communicate in were on that grid system. And the grid system you can detect. You know, you don't need a dowsing rod, or you don't need to know about some kind of mystical force, because if you test it with ionization equipment, it pours out a lot of negative ions, yeah? It will change the whole air ion effect around you. So they have they can make physical changes within us and within our consciousness.
Tell us a little bit more about that, because as far as I understand it, the same thing happens when we have lightning. Pretty much, it creates negative ions, right? It kind of neutralizes the energy, pretty much. That's how I feel, anyway, after a lightning storm. It's a great cleansing effect, kind of thing. Do they do this also with the aid of stone and geometry, or is it simply the earth energies themselves? Explain that a little bit more to us, Maria.
Yeah, sure. Well, what we have discovered, for example, my father, he got taught by some very old Chinese geomancers and European master dowsers. And all of those feng shui masters have always said one particular type of earth energy, which is like an earth spring, if you will. You know, like how water, when it comes out of the ground, bubbles and babbles, and it has a lot of energy as it breaks through to the surface. Now imagine earth energy like that, where it breaks through to the surface. It outpours. Now what it does, it outpours and it kind of goes up into the air around you. Now, you're right about negative ions. After a thunderstorm, that's what is prevalent in the air. It's the negative ions. They make you feel good. And they're kind of healing as well. Unlike positive ions, which are actually, you know, give you a headache before a thunderstorm, they're detrimental to our health, or long-term exposure to them is detrimental to our health. So what we found with our equipment, once you place that over a kind of earth spring, and remarkably, the negative ions shoot up, sometimes in their thousands, yeah. But very interestingly, it reduces the amount of positive ions. Now, we have to use what's called a control so that we know what's going on around these energy points. And when we use the ionization equipment on the control, it's normal. It will have, you know, well, a kind of equal balance, if you will, between the negative ions and the positive ions. But again, move that over an energy point and it changes dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And those points are always marked by stones in a stone circle, or they're marked by a mound in the ancient landscape surrounding the stone circles.
Tell us more about the equipment that you used to measure ionization, and was it you who came up with it, or have you worked with other people to kind of develop it? What is it?
Yeah, I work with other people. I mean, I kind of know where the energies are, like the back of my hand, because I got brought up with them by my late father. So I can go to numerous sacred sites in this area and say, this is exactly where the earth energy is. It's not here. It's not there. So David Webb, he's very good with being able to analyze the air ion qualities. And he uses a lot of instrumentation to measure the levels within the air all around the place. It could be a sacred site, it could be a house. He can test those. We've also, with Rodney Hale, who worked on a very iconic project back in the 70s called the Dragon Project, which tested ancient sites for anomalies, we used a lot of equipment to detect the Hertz frequency emitted by earth energies and megalithic energies, for example, as well as radiation tests. So we've tested stones, for example, to see if, like dowsers have said, they have seven energy points of standing stone, for instance. And those seven energy points can be equated to our chakra system. Dowsers have said that for years. You can feel them with your hands. You can use a dowsing rod to interact with that energy. But it's always been anecdotal evidence. So what we decided to do was to test that theory out to see if, you know, people like my late father were right or not with these energy points. And what we found was, as we moved the equipment up the standing stone, on those precise energy points, which are like bands that go around the stone, it's on my website actually, under megalithic energy, we got the Hertz frequency, and this is what's interesting, I think, especially so about it, is electromagnetic for one. And the frequency it comes out at is around about 15 to 18 Hertz. Now, that's just below your audible sound perception, which is, you know, roughly about, say, 20 Hertz in the average person.
Right.
So we think, you know, that when people way, way back, thousands of years ago, were highly sensitive, and possibly they could have heard the sounds emitted by the stones.
Okay, that's interesting. I thought, I always had the perception for some reason that the stones were placed potentially on a natural an energy line, if you will, of the earth itself, and this was placed there to again, maybe enhance it or alter it or do something with it. Do you think that's something to that, or are you saying that the realization that there was a tone or a frequency coming out of the stone was something that was realized after they've actually placed them in different configurations and such?
Oh no, you're absolutely right. For that stone to become active in its seven kind of pulsation energy points, it has to be like either on a grid line, it has to be either on a ley line, or spiral patterns that the earth naturally emits that are associated with underground water and aquifers. It has to be like plugged into that for that to happen.
Right.
So it's actually the earth energy being transmitted up through the stone. But what our equipment told us was that's not just it, it's then transmitting it across the landscape. So one stone is transmitting at, say, 18 Hertz, for example, is then transmitting that to its neighbor stone and further afield to the next stone circle. So it's like energy lines in Hertz frequency, electromagnetic lines that can be detected and connect ancient site to ancient site across the ceremonial landscape.
How do you think that works? Is this completely intentional on the builders, that they realize somewhere along the line that they could connect it in this way? Or was this a side effect of what they were doing? What do you think?
I think that it was intentional. I think they knew that once you put a stone into an earth energy pattern, which we'll talk about later, or a ley line or a grid line, it would start to absorb that energy through its, in all probability, through its crystal matrix structure. And bear in mind that most stones are silicon. They have a lot of silicon base in them,
yeah,
which is a bit like a modern day micro, you know, a microchip, for example, that can process information. And it can absorb that and then transmit it. I think they were harnessing that energy.
So as we've seen in Stonehenge, you have the blue stones on the inside. There's a different stone on the outsides. There seems to be special stones for different reasons, correct?
Oh, absolutely. For example, at Stonehenge, you have quite a few different types of stone. You have the sarsen stone, which is, you know, all of the very large stones at Stonehenge, the lintled stone circle and the horseshoe of gigantic trilithons on the inside. That's all sarsen. But the blue stone circle, for example, at Stonehenge came from Wales. They were picking stones. And interestingly, the blue stones, they're harder than granite, but they have twice as much magnetic energy than the other stones as well. So yeah, they were picking out stones. But very intriguingly, with the bluestone circle at Stonehenge, which was right on the inside of the lintled stone circle, that's 79.20 feet in diameter, that stone circle. And if we replace feet with miles, yeah, then and multiply that by 10, you have the diameter of the Earth, which is 7,920, for example. So they were definitely encoding things like the diameter of the Earth into their stone circles.
Yeah. So many other monuments around the world seems to have this, and it seems to be this a very similar expression, but it's evident in you know, what the remains are, that there's many different ways you can achieve it, many different structures, types of stone works that you can do to you know, express the geometry. It's fascinating to me. Let's talk about how you think that they were using it, what the purpose was for ancient man to develop this kind of system. What they were, is it for healing purposes, for amplification of something? Is it for, I mean, there's, I mean, as many theories as people, but what's yours?
Well, I think they were multifaceted. I don't think there's one answer to it. I think, for example, some of the energies that the stones were tapping into were definitely healing. Others, I think, were a little bit more stranger. And in all honesty, I don't know the exact purpose of what they were doing, but I can see what the vestiges they left behind. For example, in the Stonehenge environs, long, long before Stonehenge was built, you had a gigantic, colossal earthwork, yeah? Now, by earthwork, what I mean is for 2 miles across the landscape, right in front of Stonehenge, with earthen banks that rose about 10 feet high, enclosing an area about 310 feet across, you had this gigantic structure with no entrance. Yeah, so nobody could get in or out of this structure. And of course, the archaeologists always label the same thing. Oh, it was for death rites. You know, like the King's Chamber, it's all about death.
Sure.
In the ancient world.
Yeah.
But you know, evidently you could not have entered that monument. Now, sadly, it got ploughed away about 100 and 150 years ago. So it's just like bumps in the landscape left of where this colossal earthwork was. Now, when we took our Geiger counters into that part of the monument, which is like the near center of that, there was a huge outpouring of gamma rays. And gamma rays are actually quite destructive. You know, you wouldn't want long-term exposure to gamma rays. Very strangely, we did tests over 2 years to see, you know, did these energies of radiation just flare up? Is it from cosmic radiation? What is the kind of source of that? And very strangely, we found that it correlated to the position of the sun in the heavens, and they would flare up round about the time of the equinoxes, for example, to quite high levels. So normally the background radiation count at Stonehenge, for example, is about 70 counts per minute. Over these anomalous areas, they rise to 310 counts per minute.
Mm-hmm.
So these monuments that are associated with Stonehenge seem to be harboring either a background trace of gamma radiation or something occurred there at that time, because the Earth shouldn't be behaving like that in that particular part of the UK.
What do you think that means? What is it pointing to?
Well, you see, when the Dragon Project looked at other monuments around the world, with Rodney Hale, who I worked with as well, they found that the radiation levels of the King's Chamber, for example, were identical to the radiation levels emitted in other monuments in the UK called dolmens and long barrows. It's almost like they were created in an environment with a particular radiation count. Now, what people have noticed that have spent, you know, an evening or a night or a couple of nights within the long barrows and the dolmens in the UK is their consciousness really does start to change. They will either start seeing things manifest, or they will literally see lots of lights flickering all around them in these type of chambers. So it seems like it could change our consciousness in some way as one facet of that.
There's so many things I want to ask you about this. I just want to try to get my head straight of where to go here next. Tell us a little bit more about the Dragon Project. This is the one that was started back in 1977, correct?
That's right. The Dragon Project was founded by Paul Devereux and John Steele to test ancient sites for things like radiation and energy lines, and if they could get a signal from any of the stones. And also to kind of look at Earth energies as well, and to look at background radiation frequencies. They were an inspiration for my work today. And they looked at ancient sites in the UK, such as the Rollright Stone Circle in Oxfordshire and Stonehenge. And they found that, you know, predominantly ancient sites in the UK, as well as other sites across the world, are associated with very strange gamma radiation levels.
That's very, very interesting. Yeah. So how do you think that this, if we can call it a science, how do you think that this was found out or implemented in the beginning? Of course, we're all trying to answer the very difficult question of who built all of this. Even the question, are they related to each other? We have things going from, up in Scandinavia, for instance, we have we had dolmens, different kind of mounds, standing stones in different configurations. They look very much the same as they do in the UK, stretches down to France, Germany. There's tons of places around in Europe where you find these. Do you think that they come all from the same people? I've heard speculation that they might be one of the beaker peoples, like the funnel beaker people. What's your take on this?
Well, if we look at the archaeological evidence to get a grander perspective on these ancient sites, for example, in the UK, the long barrows that were built, you know, about 5,000 years ago on the orthodox archaeological timeline, the skeletons remains that they found in those long barrows had predominantly long skulls. So there's a phrase over here in the archaeological community: long barrows, long skulls. Now, you're talking about the beaker people. The beaker people were migrating, it's believed, across Europe, bringing a culture with them into places like England and France alike. Now, their skulls were very different. They were very rounded. And it's perceived that the beaker people came across and entered the UK. Mm-hmm. But with them, they had, you know, particular types of beakers, pots with them, and also a kind of cultural background as well.
So do you think that they're the one behind all of these places that we see today?
Well, I mean, that was one theory many years ago, but with recent archaeological evidence, that's been dismissed, because when you start to look at the skeletal remains around the Stonehenge environs, for example, or around the Avebury environs, there's very few people from Europe that were at the time that Stonehenge was being built. They came later, it's believed now. But at one time, it was thought they were all contemporary, but it doesn't look that way at all.
Do you think they're all related? I guess the people who built all these sites are various, stretching from Scandinavia down to UK, France, Germany, and further south as well. Do you think they're all the same people?
They must have shared, I don't know about being the same people, but they must have shared some kind of wisdom or knowledge base, because all of the monuments we've been talking about across northern Europe, if you will, are associated with just such particular Earth energies that cannot be coincidental. And they were looking for a particular type of Earth energy associated with underground water, for example. And that was called by dowsers today here in the UK and across Europe, the geospiral pattern. Imagine that the Earth can emit above large sources of water a spiral pattern, in the ground. And water diviners can pick up on this quite easily. Wherever you have that kind of spiral pattern, that represents a particular type of water. Because to most water diviners and geomancers, there's two types of water. The water associated with the spiral pattern is believed to have been created deep within the earth, independent of rainfall, for example. Mm-hmm. Chemically produced deep within the earth, and emits this spiral pattern. Now, that was the pattern that the ancients would look for to site their monuments upon, to give it kind of, to imbue the sites with healing energy. And it's quite interesting because wherever this type of water from this type of aquifer breaks through to the surface, that's what the ancients called a sacred spring. Wherever this water was brought in the medieval times, that was your holy well because it was deemed to be sacred and it was deemed to be all healing. Unlike the aquifers that are produced by rainwater, where rainwater falls in the earth and fills up all the underground streams and the underground lakes. So it's believed that the kind of feminine water, if you will, that's produced deep within the earth produces a healing force that was tapped into and structures were sited upon that spiral pattern. And that has been in dowsing law and water divining law for many, many years.
This spiral that you're talking about, do you think it could have anything to do with the labyrinths that we find, this little stone, another kind of stonework you could see is sometimes carved into the ground? I think Sweden actually is one of the countries that have the most of these around. There can be very small in some cases to fairly large. It's not a massive, impressive object that you can see with huge stones, as that is, they're kind of laid at the ground, but it also has this kind of spiraling motion to it. I mean, some people speculated that it's some kind of initiatory, ceremonial thing that was ongoing there, and it's more for symbolic purposes than an actual usage in that regard. But have you heard about these labyrinths that have this kind of spiral pattern to it, and do you think it has anything to do with this knowledge about the water?
Oh, absolutely. The two are intimately associated for certain, because the ancients would look out for this. And it's electromagnetic. This type of underground water interacts with the Earth's magnetic field, and it creates a higher kind of electromagnetic environment above it. And the ancients would look for that, and they would mark it out in types of labyrinths, or they'd mark it with a mound, or they'd mark it with a standing stone, because they knew that if they could tap into that kind of electromagnetic force field, that it would be deemed to be beneficial to the human body and to organic life alike.
Hmm. So let's try to deconstruct the idea of the differences here, if you will, as well, of different kinds of ley lines, the earth energies. There are, dragon lines, there's the Mary line, there are the Curry lines, there are all kinds of different types, different ones. How would you kind of unravel this for someone who's kind of fairly new to this, Maria?
Oh, absolutely. It can be quite confusing. I think if we kind of go back to basics, for example, a ley line, for instance, is literally a long straight line that has to have, at least five or more sacred sites sited upon it. Yeah, that's your archetypal type of ley line. A very large ley line in the UK, for example, is called the St. Michael ley line. It goes from Cornwall to Norfolk. It's 300 miles long, that ley line. And sited at the exact center of that ley line is the Avery Henge complex that contains the world's largest stone circle, right at the exact center of that ley line. So that's what a ley line is. Yeah. And you can get short ley lines, you can get long ley lines, you can get ley lines that go around the world, for example. They come in all shapes and sizes, a bit like the human race, for example.
Yeah.
But some ley lines have ley systems associated with them, and this is where the dragon lines, like Mary and Michael, as they're called, come in. So imagine for one moment you've got a dead straight linear ley line, and let's make it really long, 300 miles, like the St. Michael ley line. If you imagine now, in coiling that ley line, are two big, mighty rivers of energy that are highly magnetic. They're the dragon lines that coil around the ley line in a caduceus-style way. Do you know the symbol of the caduceus?
Oh, sure.
Well, absolutely. That's what a ley system looks like. And, for example, back in the 1980s, a master dowser called Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst, they discovered the dragon systems here in the UK. And they coined them Mary and Michael, the dragon lines. And they coined them Mary and Michael because, and this is quite remarkable, and this shows how the ancient wisdom of the Neolithic period of 3000 BC was handed down to the Templars. Because, for example, on the female magnetic Mary river of energy, for example, near enough, every 5 to 10 miles, there was a church dedicated to either Mary Magdalene or the Virgin Mary, precisely on that energy current that meanders around the ley line. And guess what? On the Michael line, again, every 5 to 10 miles, you would get a church dedicated to St. Michael or St. George, both of which were dragon slayers, exactly aligned upon those currents, and hence the term Mary and Michael.
Is this, okay, so symbolically, they're slaying the dragon. Does that mean that they're cutting the energy or using it in some way?
That's a very, very interesting comment. Yeah, a lot of people think they were using the earth energy, the dragon lines, for instance. So we have to see that these energy systems, yeah, are very vital to ancient sites, because once you place the ancient site on that ley system, for example, on the Mary and Michael currents, again, it's believed to imbue the whole site with the earth force. And churches alike, which is what Hamish and Paul discovered in their journey of dowsing this ley line.
Earlier, said Maria, that you basically today you feel these lines. Do you think that this is how the ancient builders at least started then to utilize this? That they could, I don't know, walk through an area. Let's say they were migrating new to an area, and they could instantly. Maybe even hear it, as you said, as well, because of the low rumble. They had a finer, more nuanced hearing than we do today, something like that. I don't know. And therefore, they noticed that, okay, something is different here. We need to ritualistically mark it in some way, or kind of emphasize what's already there naturally. Or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think they were marking it. They knew where these earth currents were flowing. I mean, in England, you see, we didn't document anything about these energy systems, or why Stonehenge is where it is, or why Avebury is where it is. But they did document it in ancient China, contemporary with when Avebury was being built, on those types of currents and on that ley system. And they called these energy lines collectively, the male and the female, Mary and Michael, Lung Mei, the dragon's breath, the power in the land. And what the ancient Chinese feng shui masters were looking for was crossing points, so where the two energies came together. And wherever the dragon lines crossed, for example, was said to be a place that was very special, and it was then reserved only for the emperor's palace or the emperor's tomb or some kind of like royal connection, because it was believed that that would enhance your life force and enhance the fertility of the environ as well. So they were tapping into that energy system, and they would want it to flow at a particular harmonic rate. And if a ley line was flowing too fast, for example, they put a long, tall column or a long, tall stone, like earth acupuncture, into that line to get it to slow down a little bit. So they believed that they were life-enhancing from the get-go.
Does that to you mean that, well, I've heard others speculate about the the catastrophes, the cyclical catastrophe that has seemed to have occurred on Earth many different times, but the recent, most recent one going back to 13,000 years, something like that. Do you think it's because of this that the energy system, the grid system of the Earth is slightly, it's not in its prime condition practically, and this is why it had need to be adjusted, kind of like a human body that gets out of whack a little bit. You go and get some acupuncture to kind of get the energy body aligned and back in order again, or what's the deeper reason, do you think?
Well, I think what the ancients were doing, they evidently knew about these energy systems, and they were placing monuments upon them. We know that for sure. But it does seem that at some point, maybe something went slightly wrong in some way, or there was an overload to the system. Yeah, because, I mentioned earlier at the Cursus Monument, you have huge outpourings of gamma radiation, and you have that at some stone circles like Rollright, which I mentioned earlier, the Dragon Project. Discovered. And what a lot of more modern-day archaeologists think about sites like Stonehenge and like Avebury is they didn't fall into a state of ruin. Maybe at one point they were actually dismantled. So it could be, for example, that something went wrong with the energy system, for instance, could be one interpretation, and therefore it was dismantled. Because it's always been intriguing to archaeologists how some of the lintels right on the tops of the stones at Stonehenge literally just disappeared. They didn't use them for building material in the later years. Some of them just seem to have gone. And some of them were quite carefully placed almost on the floor. Some of the ruinous stones at Stonehenge looked like they were placed there, not that they fell. Some fell, but some looked that they were deliberately placed.
To kind of cap the, almost like, I mean, you explained it like a circuit board, or, you know, how energy flows through a computer pretty much. And that means that there might have been a surcharge almost. Would that be fair to say it like that?
I think here in the UK there was something around the Stonehenge environ that kind of blew a fuse, if you will. something blew. And it really did frighten, I think, some of the people, because the archaeological evidence that is around is quite intriguing. Stonehenge at its first phase, was like just a blue stone circle, for instance, containing 56 blue stones from Wales. That's about 130 miles away. That was the first phase. And later the trilithons and the Stonehenge that you know and you're familiar with came. So when Stonehenge was first built in that kind of stone circle, it lasted for 500 years. People were going there for 500 years, and then it was abandoned. People left the area. Then they came back 500 years later to build the iconic stone circle that we recognize today. There was a point where people just left, and Stonehenge became a wreck and ruin, literally, because it was uncared for. Now, when you look, for example, down a timeline, an archaeological timeline, all the archaeologists say it started in 3000 BC, as the stone circle I just described, the 56 blue stones surrounded by a ditch and a bank. And then in 2500 BC, they built the iconic stone circles that we are familiar with today. That's 500 years of difference, which they don't talk about, and that's because people abandoned the area. Something really spooked those people.
Do you think the same people came back, or was there another tribe, a race, basically, that moved in and kind of picked up on where the previous one left off, if you will?
Well, that could be. Whatever made those people move away from the area, they did so literally quite fast. And again, very strangely, what's recorded around Stonehenge and nowhere else in the UK is whatever those people experienced, whether it was a power surge or something, you know, quite natural happened in that area, it's very difficult to say.
Yeah.
But what we do know is they then went back to all of the long barrows, and that's the people that were interned, you know, their ancestors that were laid to rest in the long barrows, and they gave them a second killing. That is, they took the bones and started to smash them as if they were venting their anger on these people for some reason. So it's called a twice killing. And there's a lot of documented evidence for that in this area. So something really kind of frightened those people.
Like they constructed something that they, well, what I'm thinking about is like opening Pandora's box a little bit. You're messing with, you know, forces that you might not really be sure of. Could that be the case?
It could very well be the case, because 500 years passed. And the first phase of Stonehenge, you have to imagine now trees grew up in it. It was laid as a waste. Yep. And nobody would go near the place. In fact, they settled, you know, like 4 or 5 miles away from that. Then when the 500 years passed, they then came back to Stonehenge and rebooted it, if you like, and rebuilt it with the stone circle that we're familiar with now.
It's fascinating to me how these incredible monuments can just go into, you know, oblivion, that they're forgotten like this, and the humans in the area kind of turned their back on it. But again, who knows what actually happened? But one thing that's clear here is that there's different phases of the construction, or potentially even usage of it. Let's talk about how it actually originally look, and we can talk about the different phases as well, if you want to, you know, just touch upon the blue stones first, and then later on in 2500 BC when the additional ring is set in place, how did that look?
Oh, well, again, you know, loads of people can Google images of Stonehenge, and what they see is grey stones on Salisbury Plain, and they look kind of dull, and in different lights they can look a bit lighter. But that's after 4,500 years of weathering. So that is not how our ancient ancestors saw Stonehenge, not at all. For example, the lintel stone circle that contained the 30 lozenger-shaped stones with all the lintels on top, that gleamed white and silver. Yeah, it was very, very highly polished. It was worked very well. And bear in mind, you know, the lozenger-shaped stones of Stonehenge came from natural boulders, and they were made to fit into a particular shape. And it would have looked spectacular. Now let's step inside the monument. And if you walked about 5 or 6 feet inside of that lintel stone circle, you come across the blue stone circle at Stonehenge. And again, that was highly polished. In fact, bluestone is quite a remarkable, very attractive stone, because it appears midnight blue and it has flecks of white feldspar dappled throughout of it. And when it's highly polished, it looks like the star-spangled midnight sky, very dramatic looking. So then we're going to step 8 or so paces forward, and now we're into the real sanctity, the central feature of Stonehenge, which is 5 great trilithons. Some of which are way up to 90 tons with 16 tons of lintel above them. And these stones were even more polished than the outer lintelled ring, so they appeared very, very white. And then the centerpiece, called the altar stone, which marked the near center of Stonehenge and marked the geospiral pattern we were talking about earlier, was absolutely dramatic. It was an olive green color, flecked with garnets red and mica white. It was very dramatic looking and very beautiful.
Is there, or have there been found remnant of this around in the area when there's been excavation, or how do we know this?
Oh, we know this because it's very widely documented in lots of archaeological reports. You can see it very carefully. I mean, if you look very carefully, you know where to look at Stonehenge, for instance. You can easily make out the garnet flexes in the altar stone. Just people don't know what they're looking for, and they see everything as quite grey. But all of this is very widely documented by most archaeologists. It's just not written about so much on the internet by researchers. They just look at what they see now. That's that's a mistake when it comes to Stonehenge.
Well, fascinating. There's a lot of interesting material here that we're going through with Maria Wheatley. We have much more to talk about, of course, many more questions to ask about your work and these extraordinary monuments and the energy lines in the earth, as it were. But let's take a short break here. We're going to carry on in the second hour. But before we do that, though, Maria, I want to ask you more about your website. I want to talk a little bit about the upcoming event that you have together with Gary Evans, who was with us a while back, on the megalithic temples of ancient Britain and Ireland. It's an event upcoming in July here. We want to give out some of the details for that. So wherever you want to begin, Maria, with that, please go ahead.
Yeah, sure. What Gary and I have put together is a kind of tour of all the ancient sites in the UK, including Stonehenge and Avebury and the Uffington White Horse Complex. These are really ancient British sites in the southwest of England. And then we're going to go to Ireland, which is a wonderful country that has very old monuments, some of which are actually about 1,000 or 1,500 years older than Avebury or Stonehenge, such as Newgrange, for example, and Sligo. And we're going to have a look at, you know, the different types of energies that these site and their acoustic properties and their harmonic properties, and really kind of interact with the different types of earth energy and the way that it reflects in our own consciousness and how to interact with these energies. It should be quite exciting.
Oh, indeed. It's fascinating. And there's so many different sites, of course, that you guys have in store here for this event. We're going to have the links up to this, of course, so people want to know more. July 15th to the 28th, now this year, 2013. And much more to read about right there. Before we also leave, though, for this first hour, Maria, I want to ask you a little bit more about your website, where people can go to find out more about you. Do you have books or other material out there for people to dig further into?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my website is theaveburyexperience.co.uk, and I've had a few books published about Avebury and Stonehenge, for example, available on my website. And recently I've had a book published in the States, which was a kind of revamp of one of my late father's Dowson books by Ozark Mountain Publishing. That's Dolores Cannon's publishing house. And it's called The Essential Dowsing Guide, and that takes you through all the different types of energies found in different monuments, be that a temple church, for example, the layout of a temple church, the types of energies we find in stone circles, you know, such as the geospiral phenomenon, the earth currents like Mary and Michael. It's a kind of practical guide to the unseen earth forces.
All right, you want to give out the website here one more time before we take a break here then. TheAveburyExperience.co.uk, that's Maria's website. And then you have infinite-connections.co.uk, and you can just go under tours and go down to July 2013 UK and Ireland tour, and you'll find more about this. But we'll have the links up on redicecreations.com, so you can click through easily from there. All right, well, we'll end it for this first hour. Stay with us, Maria, and everyone else. We'll be right back with more in a little bit.
Hundreds of years before the dawn of history, lived a strange race of people, the Druids. No one knows who they were or what they were doing. Remains hewn into the living rock of Stonehenge. Stonehenge, where the demons dwell, where the banshees live and they do live. Stonehenge, where a man and the children dance to the pipe.
I will take you there. I will show you how.
We are going to proceed in the second hour with Maria Wheatley shortly. We'll talk more about the Curry Grid and the harmful effects of Earth energies. Maria explains the basics of dowsing and how to locate both the neutral spaces and those causing geopathic stress. If you're sleeping night after night for an extended period, right over one of these crossings, it could mean trouble. Maria shares what she believes is the real age of Stonehenge, the difficulty with dating, but also how finds pointing to an earlier date are conveniently ignored by scientists who already have formulated their hypothesis. Later we talk about a strange metal plate object found near Stonehenge, dating back to the Elizabethan era. Also discussed is harmonic surface patterns, spirals, and labyrinths. When you want to hear the continuation of this or any of our previous programs, you need a subscription to redicemembers.com. We have every single program archived there for you and a whole lot more. It's only €5 per month. We have subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years. So whenever you want to hear the rest of the story, please take a look. Some of our upcoming guests on Red Ice includes Ralph Ellis, Troy McLaughlin with Theodore A. Holden, Ulle Damgård, Harry Hubbard, Penny Pierce, Graham Hancock, Lloyd Pye with Brian Forrester and Jerry Willis. We'll return with more in just a few days, and we welcome you to listen again. As you know, you can tune in whenever you want, but foremost, I hope you continue to listen to Maria and me in the second hour as we continue the discussion with all our supportive friends at redicemembers.com. Thank you for listening.